K-Mud Environment Show. Hey everyone, I am your host, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. We have a full show for you today. First, Jamie Mattioli from Caltrans is joining the show to talk about the Last Chance Grade project. And then I'm going to be joined by Mark Green of Cal Wild to talk about kind of the state of environmentalism today, where we are succeeding, where we are failing, and what is the future for our movement. So first, let's get to Jamie Mattioli and Last Chance Grade. Welcome to the K-Mud Environment Show, Jamie.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Tom. Good to be here.
Yeah, this has been great. I appreciate you coming in. I think we have you on about once a year to give an update on what's going on the Last Chance Grade project. So if folks have been living under a rock, because we've been talking about Last Chance Grade for over a decade now, what is the Last Chance Grade project? Where are we in the world, and what is being proposed?
Okay, so Last Chance Grade is a 3 mile stretch of road, 10 miles south of Crescent City. So you've driven up there, Highway 101, and it's the part of the road where we're constantly working. It climbs a hill. You start at Wilson Creek Beach. There's a nice beach, nice picnic spot out there at the south end. And you cross a bridge and you climb a hill, and the road undulates up and down. Then you get to the last mile, and there's about 2 dozen retaining walls that have been constructed over the last 20 years. So it's a place we're always working. So you've probably seen it.
You've probably been stuck in traffic there.
You probably have. There was a 9 year stretch that ended a few years ago where we were down to one lane traffic control for 9 years straight. So there's kids who grew up in the area and they've never known that there's two lanes at Last Chance Grade. There's two jobs that we have at Last Chance Grade. One is what you see is our maintenance and emergency response crews. Keeping the road open and safe because there's chronic landslide movement. The road's been moving, sliding, and slipping towards the ocean since the road's been there, more than 100 years. The current alignment's been there since 1937. Roads move 40 feet horizontal, 30 feet down. We've spent over $115 million just maintaining the road in the last 30 years, more than 100 of that just about in the last 10 years. So we have this accelerated rate of repair work and impacts to motorists. So that's that job, keeping the road open and safe. We built more than 2 dozen retaining walls that aren't fixing the problem. They're just holding the road together as the whole thing slides.
And this is, of course, such a vital link for our community. Without the 101 through Last Chance Grade, we might as well cut off Del Norte County from the rest of California. It should join Oregon because there's really no other way to get to Crescent City from Humboldt County. You can go 500 miles out of your way up the 96 across, that road from Happy Camp to Talkeetna or whatever it's called, and then back down. So, a critically important kind of bridge in our community that is at perpetual risk. So we have this road that is sliding because of historic landslides, historic and ongoing landslides. Why is this area so erosible? Why is it slipping into the ocean the way it is?
I think it's just the geologic luck of the area. So we have these Franciscan soils, geologies, up and down the coast. And then this one area, it happens that you have the geometry, the shapes of the rocks and the materials is that you have these deep-seated landslides, 250 feet deep plus. In addition, you have the toe of the slope being eroded by the coast. So it's a conveyor belt. These three massive landslides, about a mile long between the three of them, just slowly moving. And within that, you have smaller nested landslides that can be, they can move feet a year. So it's just the nature of the hillside there. It's been moving since, historic memory.
Since the road was probably originally constructed, that thing has been a problem to maintain it and keep in place. So the problem is so severe that Caltrans is envisioning a new solution to last chance grade. Tell us about what is currently the alternative that you're moving forward with, and then we can get into the process of how this was selected.
So we're moving ahead with a tunnel bypass. It's called Alternative F. It's a 1.1 mile, 6,000 foot tunnel that goes around to the east of those landslides. We have an approach earthwork where we carve a new road at the south end. And we're also proposing an operations and maintenance center that would house some of the equipment and allow operators to monitor and operate the tunnel. So that's about a third of the mile south of the southern portal that's proposed. At the north end, you come out basically in the redwood forest because the boundary is you either have old growth redwood forest or you have a landslide where you don't have the redwood forest. So to get the solid ground, unfortunately, we do have to cut through on order of an acre of that old growth redwood forest. So at that north end, there's sensitive wetland habitat. We've proposed a bridge to span over that area. So a tunnel, a bridge, realignment, and an operations and maintenance center make up the features of that alternative F.
And Alternative F is something that Caltrans has spent over a decade already in studying, and we still have more years of study left to go. EPIC has been part of some of the community outreach that Caltrans has done on this project. And from my vantage as the executive director of EPIC, I've been impressed because although Alternative F is going to be impactful, this is an area where there are no good solutions, where everything that you do is going to have an impact. And this is probably the least impactful of the alternatives. And so if we want to have a permanent road in place that is stable and secure and is not at risk of failure, and failure is pretty catastrophic if it could be catastrophic if it fails, this is going to be the least impactful of the alternatives. So I commend Caltrans on the process by which you've arrived at this alternative and the alternative itself. And as I understand it, Caltrans has come up with this idea that it's going to do a tunnel, but there's still a lot of work that's being done to further refine and develop that alternative, and there's opportunity potentially for impacts to be lessened as part of this further project design. Do you want to talk about kind of where we are and how much kind of further design work needs to be done before construction can begin?
Absolutely, Tom. Can I back up a bit, kind
Of
of
course,
the
yeah,
history?
please.
And at some point, you got to stop fighting this hillside and you start engineering around it. So that's what we began doing in the early like teens after storm damage in 2011, 2012. The community came out and said the status quo is not working for us. And Congressman Huffman formed a stakeholder group. Formed in 2013, 2014. EPIC was part of that. Friends of Del Norte was part of that. A cross section of the region, tribal leaders, elected officials, business people, others. They all agreed status quo is not working. We need a long-term solution. We should consider a tunnel. And that kicked off a feasibility study in 2014. We later had a planning study, project study report, 2016. We finally get money for the environmental phase in 2019, $50 million. That allows us to perform geotechnical explorations. We start to finalize what alternatives we're going to look at. We narrow it down to two. Started from 18. We have now geotechnical under our belt about 2020, 2021. We go in phases. We fly in drill rigs using helicopters into the gaps in the canopy so we minimize impacts from the drilling. by 2022, we have our studies complete and we're writing the draft environmental document, publish it in 2023. Then later 2024, we publicly announce, hey, we've got our preferred alternative. It's the tunnel, it's alternative F, after working closely with our stakeholders. So now we're about 2 years after that, we've gotten comments. Tom, you wrote an excellent letter following the draft environmental document. So we've been responding to comments. We've been addressing comments. We've been working with a number of agencies to get some permissions that we need. And now we're ready to publish the final environmental document, finally, with the goal very soon, early in the new year, 2026. So a huge milestone for us to get to this final environmental document. So that kicks off what we expect will be 4 years of design. And within the design phase, there's getting the actual design products that the builder needs to build. You have to get the permits and you have to acquire the right-of-way. So all of these three things are happening over the next 4 years. And it's 4 years because, one, it's a very complex project. We're not typically where we would be when you start a design phase of a project. You normally have high level of confidence in your design. Often you even have design level geotechnical investigations complete. We don't have those two things. And we're on top of a landslide that's large, complex. We've done a lot of studies. I mentioned that. We have a lot of studies left to do. Now we're into the design level studies where you really hone in. You go precisely where those portals are. We measure how deep the landslide is. We ensure that the tunnel is far enough away that we're mitigating or managing any issues. We know what type of rock is in there. We know how it's fractured, the angles, the quality of it. So we have a lot more studies to do of the geology in the next year or two. And then you mentioned we're refining the design. So there's a lot of opportunities to help to improve the design, add value, reduce cost, reduce impacts. So that's the critical next step. How do we refine this design to a point where we could say, hey, permitting agencies, this is actually what we're going to build, how we're going to build it. Here's the footprint. Start getting those permits we need and start acquiring the right-of-way. In our case, it's transfers of right-of-way from state parks and national parks. I've talked a lot, Tom. I'll pause.
Well, I'm just seeing kind of impressed all of the challenges that go into this project. So, you know, you're trying to figure out a way to get around deep-seated landslides, to go under and around them. And to do this, you have to do a lot of geotechnical work. You have to do a bunch of kind of test drilling into these hillside to see how deep the landslides go, where there's bedrock. And just as a reminder, this is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, right? This is a precious piece of state and national park that you're having to do this all in. So there are a lot of complications. And so I feel like oftentimes people will hear about last chance grade and they'll go, oh, well, why is it taking so long? Well, it's taking long because the list of challenges here are extreme. And there's a reason why, despite the road, you know, constantly failing across its entire life in this location, it's only being dealt with now. So kudos to you and your team, because this is an impressive number of obstacles y'all have to overcome. So part of the kind of uniqueness of this project is the way that you've integrated with contractors early on in the process. So as I understand it, as a layman outside the government, usually when it comes to a Caltrans project, you kind of design it in-house and then you go out and you collect bids. And usually it's the bid that's going to be the cheapest that you go with. And that's how you add asphalt onto the ground. But here it's different. So we've never constructed a tunnel in California this challenging before. Not only this challenging, but this long. So you are bypassing the way that we usually do things in order to start working with contractors who have the experience, who have done these sorts of tunnels elsewhere in the world previously. Can you talk about this kind of different way of approaching the project and what you hope to gain from it?
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Love this topic. And can I say you gave us kudos. I want to say thanks to you and your fellow stakeholders for all the amazing work you've done over the years. And that's been the wind in our sails, like the Huffman Group and other groups, cultural resources working groups, being able to meet with tribal councils, tribal governments. That's what's made us successful, in addition to our incredible team we have here at Caltrans. So yeah, we've known for a while that we should look at what we call alternative delivery, alternative procurement. Typically, we use design, bid, build. You design, you get a set of plans, you get a set of specifications, you advertise those, and the low bidder wins the job, and they construct. There's a couple options that are alternatives that we have available to us, and we looked at all the available methods. You can have design build, where one group comes in, they design, the designer and the builder work together. And the one we favored is called CMGC, Construction Manager General Contractor. And that allows us to identify, select the most qualified builder and enter into a pre-construction contract with that group, where they can help us innovate, they can help us manage risk. They could provide constructability, where they can tell us precisely this is how we will build this. Often we're making assumptions. Oh, we expect the contractor will need this much space. We expect they'll use this type of equipment, and then we inform our agency partners, this is what we expect, this is what we anticipate. But now we have the advantage of we could go, hey, Alex, what are you going to use? Alex is our prime or project manager for the group we're now working with, Barnard Trailer and Myers joint venture. So yeah, we've been able to enter into this pre-construction contract with a group that has combined, the companies combined 150 years of building structures and tunnels, and the individuals on their team, hundreds of collective years building tunnels successfully around the world. They focus on underground construction. They look for opportunities in around the world. So yeah, it's such a privilege to now be partners with this group instead of having to wait to get to construction. And sometimes they don't have all the information beforehand, and things could come out. There could be surprises, and then it leads to we have to negotiate how to resolve things. So not only are we smarter now in the design process and the environmental process, but we also build a partnership with the folks that we really need a good partnership with, our builders. We'll have less surprises. We're managing risk better. We can share some risks. We can reduce some risks. And they know how to innovate, and they know how to build. So yeah, so many benefits, and yeah, it's again great partnership moving ahead. And we were just able to introduce members of our team from the joint venture to the stakeholder group up in Oreck. Yeah, so it's great to now work with BTM.
So, while I said that a tunnel of this complexity, a tunnel of this length hasn't been done here in California previously, tunnels like this have been done elsewhere, or tunnels with similar geotechnical issues or other sort of challenges for their construction have been built elsewhere. So where are you looking as an agency for inspiration for Last Chance Grade?
So internationally, so California has built a couple of tunnels in the last 20 years, and they're really good examples because the geology is very similar. But also in Franciscan, Devil's Slide near Pacifica, and Caldecott, Fourth Bore in the East Bay, really good examples. We have team members who worked on those, and they've been able to educate us, coach us, mentor us. We continue to learn from them, but we also recognize, thousands of tunnels are built around the world, and there are places that just build more tunnels than California. So our leadership was very keen, interested on learning from folks around the world who have just more experience as owners, governments that own, operate tunnels. So we've had contacts in England, Norway, Sweden. We've been able to visit tunnels there. And now this year we just got back from a trip, two members of Caltrans got back from a trip to Japan. There's, folks know this, Crescent City has a sister city relationship with a small town called Rikuzen-Takada in northeast Japan. It's actually where the tsunami warning was just occurred yesterday. So members of stakeholder groups recommended, hey, we've got this relationship, we have contacts, would you consider going to Japan? And the more we looked into it, the more we realized Japan has this unique experience. They own and operate and have built over 11,000 road and highway tunnels. Similar geology, of course, they have seismic risks like we do, mountainous terrain. They've used similar methods, so they've kind of seen it all, done it all. And so it was very informative to learn from our counterparts in Japan at the Ministry of Land, Infrastructure, Transport and Tourism, MLIT, and to view some of their tunnels that are really good reference projects for us using similar construction methods. They had all sorts of lessons for us.
So you saw a number of tunnels. What are some things that you're bringing back from Japan that are now considerations for Last Chance Grade from that experience?
I think there's some efficiency ideas. Driving through a number of tunnels and experiencing the geometry, so the widths of their roads, so their shoulder widths are fairly narrow in their tunnels. They often had a median barrier. We saw a lot of like two-lane tunnels with a median barrier, so a barrier down the middle, narrow shoulders and pullouts for disabled vehicles and maintenance. That sparked some thinking about our assumptions about the geometry. Currently, we had assumed some wider shoulders, standard 10-foot wide. So we could look at that, and that could be that could have a lot of ramifications for cost and impact if we're able to reduce the width of the tunnel. If you imagine a circle and you reduce the width, you shave off a lot of area in that circle, and take that in three dimensions. Now you. If you reduce the width, you remove a lot of volume. Well, the cost of a tunnel is it's related to the volume of material you need to dig out of there. So looking for opportunities to have a more efficient design. We also saw examples of emergency tunnels. We're exploring a pilot tunnel. That's something we put in our environmental document. We acknowledge that. You mentioned that we're in the UNESCO World Heritage Site. So directly above the alignment of the tunnel are 300-foot tall redwood trees, and tightly packed. There's not space. There's no roads. If we're going to go in and get geotechnical investigations in there, you'd have to impact that area. So we've long proposed a pilot tunnel, exploratory tunnel, starting from either end to collect the information we need. So we saw examples of smaller tunnels that are in use in Japan. One of them was probably 20 foot wide, about 14 feet tall or so, and that accommodates emergency vehicles. And it's parallel to a larger tunnel. So that's something we want to explore for Last Chance Grade. Could we have an exploratory tunnel potentially that has some long-term use? Could it accommodate bicycles, pedestrians? Could it even have some emergency use, or it could simply be within the proposed tunnel cross section, and it's used for exploratory means, and then we dig around it. So all ideas that we're going to explore as we get into this design work.
So, no matter what we do, we're going to have impacts from this project. And the impacts are varied. There are impacts to natural resources, like old growth redwoods, and other coastal ecosystems. We also have impacts to tribal cultural resources. This is a tribal cultural landscape. The Talua Dene Nation, the Yurok tribe, and others both have an interest in this project because these are their ancestral lands. Mitigation is going to be necessary for this project. How are you conceiving of mitigation at this time, and what are the kind of general thoughts that you are bringing to the mitigation conversation?
So we've been thinking about mitigation a lot over the last few years. Working groups have been addressing this, and our environmental document will lay out a path for us to a palette, I like to think of options that we will negotiate on as before we get permits, and we will finalize in a mitigation plan. There are impacts to very sensitive communities. We expect there's some unavoidable significant impacts to late successional redwood forest, Sitka spruce forest, so old growth redwood forest, old growth spruce, and habitat for marble burlet and marble burlet. And we need to have a robust mitigation portfolio that makes it allowable. You can't replace a 2,000-year-old tree, but what can we do? What's the right thing to do so that we can move forward with the project? And so we have to work with our partners, the owners, the parks, national parks, state parks. We have to work with resource agencies and the public at large to ensure that we're doing the right thing and we have support. So we feel, we fully expect what will come out in the final environmental document will be seen as a robust mitigation portfolio. And then we'll negotiate with agencies as we're going for permits and finalize that. So a couple of things we think we can do. You can't replace an old growth tree, but there are tens of thousands of acres of cut over land, second growth lands. And much of that is within state and national parks. And there are programs, there's a particular program that brings that second growth forest closer to old growth faster than it would on its own. Thins trees out where you have trees that are too dense, opens up the canopy, improves biodiversity, performs stream restoration, road removal. So taking this cutover land and enhancing it. So restoration of lands is one of the proposed options for the habitat. The other one is, could we consider potentially some preservation of existing lands that are maybe in private hands? There doesn't seem to be a lot, maybe none, of old growth redwood that's in private hands that's not protected. But could under consideration is, could there be other private lands that could be restored? So we see it as a portfolio, as a palette of these options, and we'll refine that and we'll work with key people to reach agreement as we move ahead.
And I as I said before, Caltrans has done a great job on process on this project so far. So if you continue that sort of process for the rest of this project, I think that will bode well for the success of the project and for the lessening of environmental impacts and the mitigation of whatever impacts continue to exist. So keep up the good work, Jamie. I've been really pleased as one of your stakeholders in the work that you've done. So briefly, in the little time we have before the half hour, it's 2025 now somehow. I closed my eyes and 20 years have gone by. When do you anticipate the design phase to end and the construction phase to begin? And then when do you anticipate, you know, taking those big scissors and cutting the ribbon on the new tunnel?
Okay, so mark your calendars, 2039, Tom. You and I we're cutting the ribbon. Oh, there's probably some, like, there's probably a congressperson cutting the ribbon, but hopefully we're in the audience. We're watching, okay? But we expect to begin the design phase, again, early next year, 2026. The goal is to have design complete by the end of 2030 and getting into construction that summer of 2031. could take 8 years to complete. That's why I'm saying 2039 they cut the ribbon. But we want to look for any and all opportunities to accelerate all of that, the design and the construction, and particularly there's opportunities there with the construction.
All right, Jamie. Well, thank you so much for joining the K-Mud Environment Show. We'll have you on next time there's a big update, okay? All
Okay, thank you so much, Tom. Awesome
right,
working
thank
with you
you.
too.
All right. That was Jamie Mattioli of Caltrans talking to us about the Last Chance Grid project. Now we are going to move to talk about kind of what is going wrong and what's going right with environmentalism. This is a bit of a freeform conversation with my friend Mark Green, Executive Director of Cal Wild. Mark, welcome to the K-Mud Environment Show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right, so this was inspired by an email that a mutual friend, Chad, sent featuring an article, Is Environmentalism Out of Ideas? And I thought, you know, there's a lot here that can be unpacked and can be talked about. But first I wanted to just to say to Cal Wild, I really thought it was cool that Cal Wild came out with a statement on ICE immigration. And made a relation between people, the environment, and what's going on with our fascist government here now. So, in part, I think that this is why you're the right person to have this conversation with tonight, because I think that this idea of what the future of environmentalism is might be something around this. It might include kind of some of this intersectionality, this interrelation between different ideas. So,
Yeah,
yeah,
I
go ahead,
really
please.
believe that that's the case. When we look at the history of the environmental movement, it started out extremely white and really focused on organizing the voices of people who were white and mostly affluent. And I mean, I first got into kind of professional work as an environmental advocate. It's coming up on 40 years next year, 1986. And that was 20 years after the environmental movement had really kind of gotten going. And it was still overwhelmingly white, and it's still disproportionately white relative to the general population now. And the truth is that if we're going to be effective in doing the things like Cal Wild does, we work to protect the natural landscapes of California on federal public lands, which make up 44% of the state. If we're going to be able to do that, it's going to be through organizing Californians. And Californians are, they're Latino, they're indigenous, they're immigrants from all kinds of places. And we need to be able to talk to all of those communities and work with all of those communities to advocate for the common interest that we all have in our public lands. And I think we're a little slow to catch up to the idea of intersectionality, but it's definitely the path going forward.
And if we look at polling of people, non-white people, Latinos in particular, harbor inherent environmental ideas and values at a rate that exceeds white people. So, you know, like they are our natural constituency as environmental organizations, and it's been one that we've historically heretofore ignored or underrepresented.
Yes, and I can't conjecture why those values are more highly represented in the Latino population in California, but polling has consistently shown that that's the case. I know that when I am out on various, publicly accessible pieces of land, I will see Latino families, picnicking or, walking or doing whatever they're doing. So it's very clear that there's an interest there, right? Some of the barrier has been a language barrier, because I'm proud to say that Cal Wild actually had bilingual organizers working on advocating for the Chuckwalla National Monument, which was approved by Joe Biden a year ago in January. But that's just one small example in a very, very large effort. And of course, now what we're working to do is to defend our public lands and our wild places from a very hostile administration. And it seems as though part of what happens is that there's always an emergency that demands that we do something right now, so we're not building the infrastructure for the future. Part of that infrastructure is training bilingual people to be advocates for the environment. It's just straight up. That is a thing that really needs to happen. But are we doing it as a community? I'm not seeing it. I don't know of anybody that's taken that on as a mission piece. And it's all very easy for me, as you know, this old white guy, to kind of sit here and opine about all this stuff. But the truth is much more serious, I think. If we really want to get a handle on the biodiversity and climate crises, we are going to have to protect the natural landscapes and continually functioning ecosystems of the places where we live. And in my case, I work for California. And the only way that we're going to do that is to mobilize strong public opinion in support of that. So I would like to see that infrastructure created.
So I think that as an executive director of an environmental organization, there is where I believe that we need to go as a movement. And then there are the funders and there mm-hmm. are the members and the kind of inertia that keeps us where we are or keeps us kind of moving forward on the same track that we have been. I think a wonderful example of this has been some of the reporting on the Sierra Club from the New York Times. So, you know, my friends at the Sierra Club will say, well, the New York Times has put this way out of balance and out of context. And, you know, there might be issues, but it's been overblown. But for folks who haven't been paying attention, I'll kind of briefly recount, which is after George Floyd in 2020, the Sierra Club had a reckoning where they decided that they were going to prioritize issues of environmental justice and social justice together with kind of more standard forms of environmentalism that, you know, the Sierra Club had been engaged in for the rest of its history. And the reporting suggests that there was a donor backlash that, you know, the folks who fund and run the Sierra Club, because it's largely a volunteer organization, repelled in part and didn't like how, to use the kind of term of the day, woke the Sierra Club had been, and that, you know, longed for the days where the Sierra Club just talked about wilderness areas and the sorts of campaigns of yore. So do we have a problem at our donor base as an organization where, you know, the thought leaders within the environmental movement understand where we need to go, but are we being held back by the folks who continue to fund us?
That's a very large question, and I think teasing it apart is important. Institutional funders, by and large, understand the need for us to diversify our base of support and to mobilize the voices of people from diverse backgrounds and walks of life. Individual funders, I think, and this goes into the email exchange that we had, I think a lot of American environmentalism was rooted in a romantic idea of the wild out there somewhere. The donor base was mostly kind of suburban, you know, middle to upper middle class, white families who cared about that idea that the wild would be protected and it wouldn't all be developed, which is a noble motivation, let me just say. I mean, I grew up, there were Sierra Club books in our living room about, you know, places like Glen Canyon, which had been lost, and places like the Sierra Nevada, which had not, and which were still beautiful. And all of that was a valid motivation, but it was one that was rooted in assumptions that were not historically true. the idea that there were these vast swaths of land out there that no human had ever touched is an utterly racist idea. Indigenous people have been living here for at least 17,000 years, and all of those places were engaged with by Native people who were living there. They were living there. They were influencing the environment that surrounded them. They were practicing horticulture with plants that they found beneficial. They were doing a lot of stuff. For example, the preamble of the 1964 Wilderness Act talks about places untrammeled by man. And that's just this very, very sort of romantic idea that doesn't jibe with the reality that people have always been a part of this landscape. And it makes it harder for us as a movement to engage with tribal voices, for example, who are similarly motivated around conservation of land, but they're really insulted by that preamble. And they want the ability to do the things that traditionally they have done on these lands, and they don't want regulation to get in the way of that. Those are legitimate concerns as well. So I think all of this is kind of a reckoning, and unfortunately it's happening at a time when we're under siege. I think it's important for us to have these conversations and to kind of get over this hump, to have a broader constituency that all feeds together into advocacy for protection of places, water quality, air quality, biodiversity, and environmental justice. When you plant a particular plant, that's what comes up. And that's the roots of the conservation movement as we see it today.
So we often in the environmental movement, we'll talk about big tent environmentalism, that we're going to be bigger than we currently are. We're going to bring people in. We're going to bring in Latinos. We're going to bring in Native Americans. We're going to bring in Black communities who we haven't really brought in are Republicans. And this is now a huge issue for us. So things were fine. Things are fine for the environmental movement when Democrats are in power. Democrats are the party of environmentalists at this point. Let's be honest.
Yes.
And so, sometimes we'll feel ignored by our friends, but like generally they're not going to be hostile to our interests. We're not terribly hostile to our interests. We'll be in an okay place. We'll have enough relationships. We'll be able to engage with the sort of, electeds that matter. And then something like 2024 happens, where mm-hmm. we don't have the White House. We Democrats don't have the White House. We don't have the House of Representatives, and we don't have the Senate. And now we are on the outside looking in as Trump dismantles everything. And all of a sudden, we have to go finding environmental voices from the Republican side. So how much of our problem as an environmental movement is that we've become kind of a one-party, a one-party group. It's been polarized to the extent that we're just all Democrats now, right?
Well, I have to be careful. I had a 501c3 organization, and we're nonpartisan, and so
I am also 501c3. Yes. Maybe so, we could talk about the limitations of 501c3 organizations.
There's that too. I believe that these issues should cut across party lines, and I think it's fair to say that starting in the mid-90s, we've watched the Republican Party descend into madness. With religious fervor around issues like tax cuts and deregulation, and a deep hostility to environmental protections has been an element of that ideologically. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of Republicans that like to hunt and fish and hike and camp and do all those things. And we saw that last summer. CalWild played a big role in this. During the House reconciliation bill, we pushed really hard on Republican representatives from kind of swing districts in California to get them to oppose the sale of public lands, which was proposed in that reconciliation bill. And it worked. They stood up, they said, nope, we can't support this, and it had to get pulled out of the bill for it to pass. So, and of course, a lot of people were working on that all over the country, but California's representatives played a really key pivotal role in that. And the way that that was most effective, other than just straight up constituent calling into the office en masse, was to get folks that are hunters and fishers and, you know, voices that those Republican representatives were going to see as similar to themselves to stand up. Now, the challenge that we have is that many of those folks don't want to associate with what they consider to be woke over here, which is the intersectional engagement of people of color, indigenous people. And that's a shame. And I don't understand. How do I say this? I don't think there's any easy answer to that. We have vicious rhetoric flying around in this country on a daily basis. And more people are getting their information from social media, which is just toxic. It's very hard to build bridges between people that see one another as radically alien from one another under those circumstances. But we have to try. We just have to try. Public land sales are going to come back. They've nominated Steve Pierce of New Mexico to be the head of the Bureau of Land Management. And I mean, we call him sell-off Steve. He's hostile to the idea that the federal government should even have any land. He wants to sell it all off.
And one of the surprising champions on the public land sell-off issue was Ryan Zinke, former Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Ryan Zinke, who during the first Trump term was so bad that Epic created this joke that we were going to start calling pit toilets on our national parks stinky zinkies, that you know, to honor his environmental legacy. Now he's our environmental champion. And that is distressing to me, to my very core, that I'm reliant upon Ryan Zinke to do the right thing.
But what does it tell you?
I don't know what it tells me.
What does it tell you, Tom? What it tells you is that when he was the Secretary of the Interior, he was only accountable to Trump. Now that he's a congressional representative from Montana, he's accountable to the people that live in that district. And the people in that district want to go hunting and camping and fishing and to take their kids on a picnic and to do all those things. I go back to all politics is local, right? The way that we got folks like Kevin Kiley to move and folks like David Valadao to join the Public Lands Caucus was to make sure that the voices of their constituents were front and center, telling them we don't want to lose our public lands. So, you know, I think some of this goes to another issue that I have with kind of where the conservation movement is right now. When we talk about organizing in support of something, more and more what we're talking about is the so-called grass tops, which is like local elected officials, city councils, boards of supervisors, maybe state legislators. That's not grassroots organizing. Grassroots organizing is ordinary people, right? Local small business, faith communities, Lions clubs, that kind of stuff. And to me, it's a little bit lazy that we're not really going to the grassroots and doing the hard, labor-intensive work of organizing just plain old folks to speak up for their public lands as much as we could be. So that's another axe I have to grind.
All right. Well, let's grind that in a sec. So before, you prefaced your comments by saying, you know, I run a 501c3 organization, so I'm limited in what I can and can't say. I also run a 501c3 organization, although you know, I'm not sure to what extent I'm representing my organization here on the radio, so I will just kind of fudge it. And hopefully the IRS never listens to me, so don't report me, folks. And so many of our other friends run 501c3 organizations. If you don't know, a 501c3 nonprofit organization is that kind of nonprofit that if you give a donation to it, that is tax deductible. There are other organizations like 501c4s, which are also nonprofit organizations, but those are not tax deductible. Right. 501c4s are able to engage in partisan political activity. That's why the Sierra Club, which is our best, biggest example of a 501c4 organization, is able to go out and do legislative scorecards and tell people how their congressman voted. And, you know, Congressman Huffman got 100% and Valadao got a 40 and LaMalfa got a 10. It is part of our problem that we've failed to engage in politics in a meaningful way because we've all adopted this IRS vehicle, this 501c3, which then limits our free speech and our ability to meaningfully engage in politics. And it seems like politics is pretty important.
Well, I completely agree that politics is important. It's the way we make decisions. The 501c3 issue, I see less as about major donors, because the kinds of people that give really large sums to conservation issues, they're believers, right? They're not doing it for the tax benefit. They're doing it because they want to see something positive happen in the conservation sphere. The challenge is that a 501c4 can't take any foundation money. And that's where all the money is. The foundations, they have these large corpuses that kick off, interest or revenue every year, and then they distribute that. And those organizations are limited to giving to 501c3 organizations. So I will say two things in defense of 501c3, one of which is for CalWild, which is that we've also worked to influence Democratic representatives on these issues, because some of them are less amenable than others. But the second thing is that I think there's a value in not getting so partisan that you start to eject the people that aren't on that poll, right? And it is a real challenge to know how we can speak out on an issue like the gross violations of human rights that immigration enforcement is doing right now, without alienating people who think that it's wonderful for whatever reason they think that's wonderful. So it's a quandary.
It is a quandary. And Mark, sorry if I pepper you with these these terribly hard questions, but these are the ones I think about as the executive director, and I imagine you think about similar things too. So in our online conversation, we've talked about affordability. It is the word of the day. It is,
yeah.
If the 2024 election was about being too woke, this 2026 midterm election is going to be about affordability. And we saw Zohran Mamdani in New York kind of capture a very surprising win under the mantle of affordability. Environmentalism, I feel like, often can't stand a chance when folks have to work two jobs in order to pay the rent, when the cost of living is so high and wages are not keeping up with inflation and so on and so on. Does environmentalism have an affordability problem? And I raise this in a couple of ways. So first, we saw this year in the California legislature, the rise of YIMBYism and the use of YIMBYism as a tool of destruction against CEQA, one of our kind of core California environmental laws. And it was used effectively. And the argument was from Senator Wiener and others that this environmental law is getting in the way of housing production, and that's why your rent is so expensive. So are we failing to kind of adapt our messages and kind of live in these times to understand this affordability issue?
I think there's a suite of several factors there. First of all, the collapse of the American middle class has forced people into these bread and butter issues of survival. So thinking about longer term and bigger picture issues becomes much harder. We see this with climate change. It is the existential threat to humanity, but is it the top voting priority for people? It is not. You know, how do I feed my family and provide them with healthcare and shelter is the top line voting issue. So there's that. And then the next piece is, I lost it. I had it and I lost it.
I'll give you my hot take, which is I think that environmentalists are not conversant with issues of affordability in a way that makes it stand out that we just don't understand. So on housing issues, I remember being so mad at CEQA Works, this organization, this entity that exists to defend CEQA, because they appeared on the same letterhead as Livable California. And Livable California is like the most radically anti-housing group imaginable. They exist to defend single family houses and suburban sprawl. And for CEQA Works to be on the same letterhead on a letter critiquing, you know, oh, there's not an affordability crisis, I think was so dumb that I quit CEQA Works as an organization. It's a coalition. Mm. I quit CEQA Works and I sent a letter saying, I can't be a part of this. And so I think that part of it is that we've failed to take issues of affordability seriously. And I think that there is an environmental solution to this, which is let's release housing development in already urbanized areas. I don't get why we treat this as it is an environmental issue when we want people to live in San Francisco.
That's Wiener's argument. And he was not wrong that CEQA has been used by mostly affluent suburban homeowners to fight off multifamily housing, denser housing, all that kind of stuff. These are the issues that I kind of cut my teeth on in the 90s with Sonoma County Conservation Action, getting urban growth boundaries around the cities and pushing for smart growth and transit. The fact that the environmental community was unwilling to bend on CEQA to take that inappropriately used tool away from people who were abusing it meant that now we've lost CEQA in many significant ways. If we had been willing to say, okay, you're right, and we probably would have had to piss off some of our donors in order to do it. But if we had come to the table with folks like Wiener and said, look, we do need more housing and it should be built in the urban environment. And so let's carve out some changes to CEQA that undermine the ability of people to challenge these developments just because they don't want people anywhere near them that aren't like them. And we didn't. We didn't do that. And now we have what we have. But let me say, I do not believe that affordability in California is primarily a function of housing supply. Affordability in California is because we're in California. People want to be here. There are great jobs here. It's the most beautiful state imaginable, incredibly diverse. The people are generally, you know, pretty hip, pretty with it, pretty kind. It's just a really good place to be. And the market will raise the price of something that is that desirable. So, I mean, it's not a mistake, you know, with all due respect to Oklahoma, it is not a mistake that housing in Oklahoma costs an awful lot less than it does in California.
And it always will, because I agree, California has some special sauce to it that that makes supply and demand curves kind of more challenging than in other areas.
Yeah.
All right. So we have about 1 minute before we need to say goodbye. What is your quick cure for environmentalism, or what is you wave a magic wand? What are we doing as a movement to better meet these times and moments that we're in?
We are investing in true grassroots organizing across all political philosophies and demographics. We're building the infrastructure to actually get people plugged in around issues of common cause and understanding that they don't have to agree about everything.
I love it. All right.
That's Mark, my formula.
Mark Green, where can folks find more information about Cal Wild?
CalWild.org, CalWild.org. That's us.
All right. And Cal Wild has done fantastic work at Chuckwalla, at Satitla, at Barry S. Snow Mountain expansion, and so many other places. So thank you, Mark, for all the work that Cal Wild does. And thank you for joining us on the KMUD Environment Show.
Thank you, Tom. It's been fun.
All right.
Have a great evening.
Let's do this again. All right. Have a good night. All right, KMUD listeners, this has been another epic edition of the KMUD Environment Show. Join us again next month on the second Tuesday of every month. Until then, be well, have a happy Christmas, and I'll see you on the other side. Peace.